Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Donald J. Trump has fixed his name on the era, his whims on the agenda, his temperament on the rattled American mood, but the midterm campaign results say he is not in control even of his own fate. He hasn't dented dissent, much less broken the opposition. Historian Corey Robin makes the point that there is no Trump political order in the making yet, nothing like the Roosevelt or Reagan realignments. We're looking rather at the continuing breakdown of an old order. Finger pointing at President Trump comes next for firing his chief law officer, Jeff Sessions. And then from Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller about Trump's Russia connection. And come January, from the several House committees with subpoena power under new Democratic Party management. We are sampling the delights of American politics this hour, the swell of woman power, and also what's being called Kavanaugh's revenge on senators who opposed his Supreme Court nomination. We're calling on voices we admire from vantage points anthropological, economical, and historical more than journalistical. We begin with the literary man, David Bromwich, Sterling Professor of English at Yale. You're my favorite close reader of just about anything, David Bromwich. What did you see this week?
Well, I would say Trump had gone farther out in extreme posturing of a sort that he'd tried before, with the caravan becoming the main issue and sending 15,000 of armed forces to the border at considerable cost to the taxpayer, and making remarks that were more overtly racist than he had almost since the beginning of his campaign, when he spoke about our women don't want them, our men don't want them, and so on. So, he took that risk, and it didn't pay off. This is the first large sign, I think, of Trump losing his balance consistently in a major way, and people not falling for it, not going along with him. The Democrats seem to be able to keep concentrated on their issue of health care and of some sort of general vigilance about constitutional stability. And there's some younger Democrats coming forward now, like Stacey Abrams, who I think will be around for a while, whether she ends up winning or not, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You know, these are new faces, and the Democratic Party badly needed that. If you think about, as I said in an article a few weeks ago, you know, the most famous Democrats, the ones talked of for a potential presidential run, Warren, Biden, and Sanders, have a combined age of 220 years old. So it needed to be a young party again. Trump himself is no young man, but the contrast will become more marked with people like that around. And, you know, I took particular heart from Sherrod Brown's victory in Ohio and from Scott Walker's defeat in Wisconsin. Those are major events, because those are two of the four states that Clinton had to lose in order to lose the election in 2016. So now they're partly back.
You speak of constitutional stability, recently kind of in jeopardy. Are we back to normal? Are the Democrats back? These Democrats?
The Democrats are moving towards, I think, a renewal of energy. I think it's too early to say that the balance has been restored, far too early, because, you know, there you have it, the day after the election and after Trump speaks of, you know, having a conciliatory attitude toward the Democratic House of Representatives, he fires his own attorney general and puts himself in a position to hire somebody in that position who is essentially a flunky, just one more person who will do Trump's bidding. So the whole question of the rule of law and of Trump versus legality comes up again, as it has done so many times before, and that it's not clear that the Democrats are, what to say, briefed on that in their own councils yet, sure of how they will approach it. And I think Trump is likely to continue to protect himself, and he protects himself like someone who has something to hide.
We'll get to that TV look on his face. My sense, mainly from the turnout, but just the vigor at the end, was that we've come through the Weimar warning, this threat of tyranny. Trump still has his supporters, but he doesn't intimidate.
In the election, he did not intimidate, and in spite of the, let's call them, infrastructure problems, these voting machines aren't working well in the greatest democracy in the world. We can't get voting machines to work right, quite apart from questions of, interference with votes from, ridiculous claims made about the need for ID and so on. But, I think Trump has not succeeded in intimidating the country at large. But he does have what he showed from the start, a sort of unique, contagious power to drive other people almost as crazy as he is. And I don't think that's gone. I think the posturing and provocations, some of them coming from what Claire McCaskill called the crazies on the left, far more and more dangerous coming on the right, I think that may continue, and some of what the future holds will depend on what comes of that.
In short, I was feeling he's not going to be Hitler, but he might just be Nixon if he fires Robert Mueller, don't you suppose?
How
do you read the Jeff Sessions story?
I think he's Nixon. He's Nixon and a good deal else. No two things are alike in history, and the use of the word fascism about certain tendencies in the Republican Party and Trump, and the use of any sort of comparison with Hitler. I mean, these were misjudged from the start. But he is somebody with no respect for legality. He does not abide by the rule of law. He didn't in his business career. He won't now. In a certain sense, he doesn't even know what it is. The language he adopted in describing the murder of the Saudi journalist Khashoggi, saying it was a bad concept, terribly executed, and the worst cover-up in history. I mean, those were almost his words, which is to say he sounded like an expert in criminality judging a botched criminal operation. And that's not the voice of a president talking about international conduct in accord with the rule of law. He just doesn't have it in him to do that. So he's maybe a little more like Bertolt Brecht's vision of Hitler and the irresistible rise of Arturo Uy. That is, there's an element of farcicality and buffoonery in it at all times. And he profits from that. He can make you laugh. The vulgarity of the man goes with the brutality, and he can make people laugh. And, gosh, I hope the Democrats can find somebody who can make us laugh, too.
David Bromwich, I want you to read that pouting, impulsive, repetitive performance on television at the press conference. It went on and on and on. I just want to say one thing. He's right that if Barack Obama had racked up the Trump numbers on the unemployment, Barack Obama would have been sainted by now.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get credit for that. But then look at all the other weirdness. I thought the man looked, indescribably angry, shaken, hurt.
Yeah. Well, I remember Nixon looking like his own version of that in 1973. There was always a sudden fall into borderline paranoia and a quavering of the voice, a deep voice, when Nixon started to feel that. I remember it from way back when he lost his gubernatorial run in 1962 in California and made his speech, you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore.
Right.
I saw that around the age of 10, and I couldn't believe that I was seeing somebody who had once wanted to be president. Trump has something much worse. I mean, there is a thin skin doesn't even begin to describe it, and the press conference was an exhibit of that. But I think the press did give Obama a pretty smooth run. And they've given Trump no end of harrying, prodding, pestering right from the start. I mean, you have whole, as it seems, convoys of reporters talking about his tweets every day in sarcastic and unpleasant terms. And yet it is Trump using the social media to his advantage in a whole new way, the tweets being the main device for it. It's by dint of that he's commandeered the kind of popularity that he has. So I think people still don't know quite what to make of him, what to make of his magnetic hold on the people he does have in his thrall. And I think the press haven't got the rhythm of it yet either. I thought the exchange between him and Jim Acosta.
Yeah, who won that? Who won that bout?
I don't think either of them did. I think that the press have managed to, and that episode brought it out. They've managed to make Trump keep on looking ugly without themselves beginning to look good. So, I mean, that's a generalization, and there are exceptions. But I think a more sober, if I can say it this way, constitutional and dry method of reporting on Trump without so much enthusiasm or throwing up of hands or sarcasm or staggering would serve the Republic better because it would make a sharper contrast with Trump himself.
What would Jim Acosta have sounded like? Or would he have just cut it short after one question?
What would who have sounded like?
Jim Acosta. I mean,
I think he made his point when he spoke about the horrible hyperbole, the absurd exaggeration of Trump referring to the caravan as an invasion. He should just have pointed out nobody else in the world would call it that and sat down. But, you know, the mood was of challenge and strutting and, you know, doing his own aggressive turn against Trump. And I think, you know, you have to have been a convert fully in the anti-Trump program to have enjoyed the press side of that any more than you enjoyed Trump. But in general, I think Trump seemed out of control, and one doesn't want to see the chief magistrate of the United States out of control. And he's seen that a fair amount of the time. And you think back to the meeting with Putin last summer.
I mean, Helsinki, whatever it was.
Yeah, it made a similar impression for very different reasons. He seemed half asleep there.
David Brumbert, stand by. Coming up, the play of technology and culture, identity, and language in the campaign season just finished. This is Open Source. The ship of state was shivering to its timbers when historian Jill Lepore finished her 500-year epic with the Jeffersonian title, These Truths. There is pressure, she wrote, on our big three American premises, the natural rights and equal standing of all citizens, and our investment in free people's rule. This week, in conversation, Jill Lepore took the big turnout on Tuesday as a healthy, instinctive exercise in balancing power, but she had big reservations about the way we frame issues in social network time.
What I have been quite fascinated by this election cycle and kind of consumed by as a matter of inquiry is a significant loss of faith in the idea of representation itself. And the interest in essentially a politics of the plebiscite. And that's how Twitter works, and that's how Facebook works, and so much of how the political conversation of the fall about the Supreme Court, the whole kind of Kavanaugh controversy, was about highly volatile, super inflated Hindenburg-style public opinion, wherein people cast aside the constitutional nature of the process by which Supreme Court justices are nominated and confirmed, that is actually designed to be completely insulated from public opinion. The people that the president nominates and that the Senate confirms or fails to confirm to the Supreme Court are not answerable to public opinion. They're not meant to be answerable to public opinion, but our political culture has been so distorted by social media that And people don't quite understand what the actual process is, right? So I remember reading in the Washington Post the day after Kavanaugh was confirmed a story about that was reporting polling results of something like 62% of Americans, a significant majority of Americans, through Kavanaugh not being confirmed. And the entire story was just about this polling result, absent any acknowledgement that this isn't a matter that's put to the public for a popular vote. This is not a public referendum. This is, we don't up or down, thumbs up or thumb down someone on Twitter. When I was thinking about that a lot when I was watching the election returns last night, I was relieved to see people really interested in talking about representation and what it means to vote in your district for someone to represent the interests of your district, as opposed to you blurting out on Twitter your personal views and expecting those to be attended to on a one-to-one basis by people who are elected officials. So that was somewhat heartening to me, because I do worry about this, the politics of the plebiscite. It's actually just the underside of the politics of authoritarianism.
David Bromwich at Yale, speak to that gap Jill Lepore is seeing between constitutional government and the culture of social media.
Yeah, I think social media are the enemy of constitutional government. I'd say it flat like that. Because the sort of deliberation presupposed by the authors of the Federalist Papers and the drafters of the Constitution meant serious discussion of public issues. Parties didn't yet quite exist at that time, but they soon came to be embodied in the U.S. You have major parties, people associated by agreement over views which they have discussed. And a 140 characters send to somebody, or a like or a dislike, a thumbs down or a thumbs up, doesn't add up to discussion at all. It is a manifestation of mass behavior. And there's a phenomenon allied to this that began to be observed in the second, third, fourth year of the French Revolution. And a great scholar of political thought, Jacob Talman, wrote a book called The Origins of Totalitarian Democracy. And he meant by that just what Jill Lepore is calling this plebiscitory emphasis. You can't have people just shooting what they believe at each other and trying to get mass agreement on the basis of the very superficial face of opinions. That is a kind of populism, too, and even if it were to swing left instead of right, it does not produce a civic life. So something has to be done about social media, and it's going to have to be done soon, because I think it's not just the Russians interfering that are the problem here.
Let's see if we can figure it out in the next 30 minutes. David Bosworth at the University of Washington in Seattle is a novelist and an anthropologist, which is to say a people watcher with a PhD. He, too, found himself wondering about the popular thrust behind the excitement and the turnout in 2018.
Well, there's a lot of animation. So the first thing that is obviously true is that there were far more people who voted than we normally do in a midterm election. And that has to do with less with rational issues than I think with emotional temper, a lot of intensity on both sides. And that intensity is, some aspects of it probably reflect genuine concern about the country. And part of it is reflected in a sense of mutual hostility between what are perceived to be enemy parties.
Which was it? I mean, I thought the intensity was as good as the turnout. There was a confidence and dedication or something in the air.
You sort of have to get back to what motivated it. And really what motivated the entire midterm election was our current president, Trump, whose outrageous behavior, but also his seduction of his quote-unquote fans, I almost prefer to call them fans than to voters first, has really animated the whole election cycle. I mean, really has animated the whole political environment since he ran for office. There's definitely a commitment, and people want to believe what they want to believe, however, and are willing to vote. So that, I think, is a strong part. But I'm deeply concerned about the underlying motives of the voting as it unfolds.
Speak about it. What's new?
It's not new. It's just been oncoming. And I think it's part of a long historical process. But it's, you know, historical processes don't tend to unfold evenly. They tend to have their breaking points or surging points. And I've just been reading a lot about the Israeli-Arab-Palestinian conflict. And actually, I have a quote here from this guy that really struck me. I have to be reading this as the election was going on. Once activated, ethnic identity, ethnic interest, and especially ethnic anxiety tend to neutralize and to subsume emotionally more abstract commitments to functional groups.
Translate that.
People need an identity. The great flaw of Western postmodern culture, the notion that globalized the economy, and that's going to be somehow deeply satisfying to people, and that the whole claim that history was over when the communism fell and the capitalism spread across the world and we'd be a happier, peaceful world where everyone was invested in this economy. Well, there are a lot of flaws in that narrative. The first, of course, is not everyone's invested equally in that economy and there were winners and losers. And we see a lot of that reflected in the election and the people who lost out in the American economy. And there's a sizable number of them and they have a legitimate beef. But also behind that is capitalism just doesn't satisfy basic human needs. It doesn't satisfy our desire for a meaningful identity. And when that promise fails or starts to fail or fails to a significant degree or fails with a certain subset or a large subset of the people, they tend to withdraw or retract or try to find an identity they can be satisfied with. And that quote talks about ethnic identity being a very powerful thing. And once ethnic anxiety is exploited, it's very difficult to reason one's way out of it. So you see an animated electorate in America. It's emotionally charged, but I'm afraid that a lot of the energy of that comes from identity politics, largely spoken. There's no one who exercises identity politics more intensely, more completely than Donald Trump.
Of course, he puts down identity politics and correctness. And
well, he summons it from the other side. So, I mean, both for left and right, you can view this and say, well, he's just doing what some people agitating on the left sometimes do, is drawing on the animosities and the anxieties and the resentments of other people and choosing identity as the way to do it. But the problem with that, of course, for the American Republic in particular, is we've always been a diverse country coming from different backgrounds, different religions. And even from the point of the revolution and the difficulty after the success of winning the war of getting people all together to have the Constitution. So we've always needed to come to some kind of agreement despite the differences in the underlying identities and have managed to do that fitfully, successfully for a couple hundred years. But I just fear now, or I'm worried now, that that consensus, which was always somewhat fragile, is breaking down. It's breaking down due to large cultural forces that Trump is exploiting, but not necessarily causing by any means.
David Bosworth, I'm always wondering, especially around election time, what's becoming of us? And I'm thinking of, you know, the great explainers of who we are, starting to Tocqueville, I suppose, or Jefferson, or the models of Emerson, Margaret Mead, people who explain the American. What do you make of us today?
Oh, I think we're pretty lost, and I'm not surprised we are, because we're sort of in between worldviews. The original worldview that Americans invented for themselves, the story they told themselves, the myth they told for themselves, had to do with both acknowledging, enhancing, and domesticating individualism. And that made sense when the Republic was first being formed because, in fact, most Americans were, I don't want to use the word entrepreneur, but they were basically either small farmers or craftsmen or shopkeepers. And they were running their own lives. They were separate from the king. And there was a practical reality undergrounding the idea that we were individuals. That's all been undermined over the years by the changes in the economy, how we interact and how we communicate with each other. That old myth of individualism, which is a very important myth and which served actually, is all good myths too, to domesticate the idea of being an individual. Because after all, individualism is inherently or possibly very likely to become antisocial if you don't invest in a moral dimension to it, on the necessity of the individual always committing to the group in times of crisis. So that whole story we're telling ourselves, it just doesn't apply anymore. Most people are not entrepreneurs, are not small businessmen, are not, most people work for larger corporations. We do not read silently in our studies. We're connecting all the time on social networks. We don't keep private diaries. We blast out our opinions in blogs. The whole temper and tone, pace of American life has changed tremendously since then. And the old stories no longer describe us or prescribe for us how we ought to behave in this new environment.
David Bosworth, what does it mean to you that we're a divided society? To me, the fundamentals are economic, and I doubt all the others that we're so alienated from each other. But what do you think?
I think we are divided. You also need some historical context. It just so happens I gave a keynote address on 1968, 50 years later. I was alive then. I went to the Democratic National Convention in 1968. I mean, there was a really divided country there. There was violence. We're not really quite at that phase yet. But there's always been some division in American life, and that was a point of cultural contact and conflict that was really nasty. It was a very, very nasty time. We got through that period, and we've had what we call culture wars, but they haven't been quite as intense, though I fear that we may be moving towards that again. I do agree with you that there's an economic source to it, but I don't believe that all the discontent in contemporary life is economic solely.
What is it?
People need identities. They need to believe in something meaningful. They need to work for, aim for, work together for something, you know, that's meaningful. And just making a profit or just purchasing products are not finally deeply satisfying to people. They're necessary to have a certain economic level of sustenance to make people, quote unquote, happy, but it's not sufficient. And we're sort of lacking that higher sense of self, in which people tend to retreat now to a sense of belonging that's based on ethnicity or religion.
David Bosworth teaches creative writing in Seattle. He wrote The Demise of Virtue in Virtual America, and most recently, Conscientious Thinking in an Age of Idiot-Savants. Brianna Gray joins us, lawyer and sometime litigator in New York. She writes politics with a progressive edge at The Intercept, which is the Glenn Greenwald magazine online. Brianna, welcome. Where was the progressive edge in 2018?
I think it was ubiquitous. I think that the force of Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016 really changed the party for the left, I would say, for the better, and in a way that doesn't seem to be going anywhere anytime soon. The story of politics since then, and certainly the story of midterms, has largely been around this divide between the left and the center left and how the Democratic Party was going to reconcile its commitment to kind of third way incrementalism, exemplified by the Hillary Clinton campaign, with this growing populist movement where now today a majority of Americans, an overwhelming majority of Americans, and a slim majority of Republicans even support programs like Medicare for All. And, you know, how far is the Democratic Party and whatever potential 2020 candidates now coming to the fore, how far are they going to try to ride this progressive movement, and how much are we going to end up in another one of these battles between the left and the center left?
Let me ask it a different way. Why did the Democrats win, the ones who did win, against Scott Walker, for example?
Or I think there pick are, a candidate. I mean, the issue with kind of drawing conclusions from the results on Tuesday is that there are so many factors that were relevant in each of these races that it's difficult to draw overall conclusions. You have to look at how much money was spent in races, whether or not we're in red or blue districts. You have to look at, obviously, the quality of the candidate in terms of their interpersonal style, their personal messaging, whether or not they were committed to progressive issues and how vociferously they backed those issues. There are a lot of people, for example, who are very enthusiastic about Andrew Gillum's campaign in Florida, who were then frustrated with his campaigning with Hillary Clinton after getting an initial endorsement and support from Bernie Sanders before many national politicians started to pay attention. Then, you know, when he started to campaign with Hillary Clinton and people felt that he had started to walk back some of his language around Medicare for All. So, you know, when you look at all of those factors in tandem, it's difficult to say. And there are some prognosticators who are saying that because a lot of these progressive candidates didn't, in fact, win their election, then that is the death knell of the progressive movement. I don't think that that's accurate. Because I think what you saw is that some of the most progressive candidates were actually running in some of the reddest districts. And the fact that they were able to turn those very red districts in places like Texas and Kansas and Iowa purple says quite a bit about what the Democratic Party's expectations were.
Tell us
about what places were winnable.
Tell us about the ones we didn't see. We all halfway got to know Beto O'Rourke and Stacey Abrams. But speak of the others that are plausible models going forward. attractive models, maybe.
You saw, for instance, James Thompson in Kansas was, I believe, a former registered Republican, although he says he was a registered Republican because you have to be a Republican to vote for judges in his district, who, talks about shooting guns and has a lot of the trappings of what you would expect from a rural candidate from that part of the world. But he's also progressive, running on Medicare for All, $15 minimum wage, et cetera, and is someone that Bernie Sanders went to campaign for earlier this year over the summer, and who also campaigned with Ocasio-Cortez. She flew out to Kansas to support him as well. So I think candidates like that propose a new model where you're not, well, there's some cultural factors which aren't necessarily typical for what you would expect of a Democratic candidate, that they don't at all compromise the progressivism that they're running for. And I will say that when I go to these districts, when I go to places like that, or when I was in Iowa recently, again, with Bernie Sanders a few weeks ago, one of the things that stood out was how much applause there was, in particular, for candidates who don't take corporate PAC money. Hmm. And in places like, Iowa, where places like the Midwest, where the Koch brothers are such a force and people understand the extent to which they have undermined democracy, I think that distancing oneself from corporate money is an incredible draw that is able to draw people across partisan lines.
Brianna Gray, stand by. Coming up, the political economist Mark Blythe spirits us to his own hometown pub in Scotland to explain why the whole world is hurting and what American politics doesn't begin to address. This is Open Source. Listening to Mark Blythe down the road at Brown University, we always picture a sort of young version of Sean Connery playing the noisiest guy in a Glasgow pub, exposing the power stakes in global politics and how we mostly misread them. Mark, didn't see much improvement in our election results this week.
If you want to, focus on why these elections didn't move the needle, when you've got basically some of the best growth figures, even if wages still aren't rising, in half a generation, and most people, turns out, really don't care about Russia, then it sort of explains itself. So basically, the Democrats fell back on two things. The left wing of the Democrats, which had quite a degree of success, managed to talk about Medicare for All, managed to talk about a job guarantee, which is a horrible, horrible name for a quite good policy, but that's a different story. And the mainstream Democrats really just said, Trump's awful, Russia. Trump's awful, Russia. And it turns out that 40% of Americans really don't care, and in fact find that quite annoying. Why are we focusing on this as an American issue? The Italian party system imploded 12 months ago. Merkel is resigning. The SPD, the historically most strong centre-left party in the world, is polling less than the Greens. The Greens are now the second opposition party in Germany. The French political system completely imploded. There's a guy called Macron who's kind of a centre populist cipher who doesn't stand for anything. We got Brexit going on. That's just one corner of Europe. Brazil just elected someone that makes Trump look like Al Gore. Right? I mean, this is a global phenomenon. So why is this a global phenomenon? It's a global phenomenon for many reasons, but the simplest one being, when you unleash the forces of market competition and integration, the first thing that happens is that wages get squeezed. The way that people fill in the gap when wages getting squeezed is by, luckily, finance is liberated so you can borrow money. When you borrow money to fill in that gap in consumption and investment, it's fine so long as your income's growing, but your income isn't growing. Your ability to claim your share of product productivity gains is completely attenuated because capital can move not just money, but literally your job. So if you're in the United States and you ask for a wage increase, you get nothing because if at the end of the day the employer doesn't want to do it, they either don't do it, they don't have to do it, or they can move the job somewhere else. In Europe, the dynamics are similar. The people who voted for Brexit in Sunderland, who worked in a car factory where 90% of the output went to the EU, aren't being irrational because if all the returns are going to the stockholders of the company and the CEO, every contract they're signing is worse, and they constantly get told, if you don't take this shorter bathroom break and crappy wage increase, we'll move the plant to France. And then you tell the guys in France that you'll move the plant to Romania. So, you know, these dynamics have been building for years and years. Now, in 2008, that ability to smother all this up with credit kind of vanished with the financial crisis. We bailed it at the cost of austerity on budgets. And after 10 years of austerity, as you see in Britain, even the Tories are saying it's the end of austerity because they know they simply can't keep this system going.
What rings of truth did you hear in the American campaign this year?
None.
Really?
No, none. I mean, essentially from the Republican side, you've got a cyclical upturn which has been juiced by massive tax cuts and debt-fueled consumption, which basically has been our business model for the past 30 years, so don't knock it. And we seem to be going further with this than people think. You got people on the Democratic side saying, oh, we're late in the cycle, which is code for, I hope this ends soon on his watch rather than on our watch. On the Democratic side, rather than actually confronting these issues directly of why people are concerned with not just globalization, but economic change, what's going to happen with technology, what's happening to their job, what's going to happen to them in retirement. Instead of actually talking about these issues, it's Trump's a really bad man. Don't you think he's a really bad man? He's beyond the pale. He's a really bad man. We have to not vote for Trump. So, you know, I just see basically sort of most to hell with you, more for us is the Republican answer. And then the Democratic challenge to that is Russia, Trump's a bad man.
Mark Blythe, you wrote a book called Austerity. What would it take for Americans to realize that we're living under a whole set of policy and cultural assumptions of austerity? Student debt, the abandonment of Donald Trump's own infrastructure plans, the squeeze on public spending of all kinds, at the same time, the generation of incredible individual private wealth. I'm wondering why we don't talk about it. And is there a moment when we'll have to talk about it?
Not so long as basically all Congress pays attention to is the preferences of the top 20% of the population who are getting the crumbs from the top 1%'s growth model and are doing quite fine. So if you have income stagnation for the rest of the country, so long as the Fed doesn't increase rates too much, they'll be able to continue to revolve their student debt and their credit card balances, etc. Now, over the long run, this is actually quite bad because if you have a generation that's growing up with debt before they have assets, it stops them forming assets. So in plain language, if I'm paying back student loans, I'm not accumulating money for a deposit, so I'll never have a mortgage. So what you end up doing is making sure the old people who have 80% of all financial assets in the United States effectively maintain control well into their dotage, and that younger people coming up don't have the assets to actually continue to thrive and grow the economy. And that's a huge intergenerational misallocation, which we don't talk about. And why don't we talk about that? Because old people vote twice as much as young people and have 80% of everything. So that's who politicians pay attention to.
We talk personalities that we love and hate, fads, immigration, caravans in American politics. I would have said that this campaign leaves a wide open field for a more fruitful conversation, shall we say, or real confrontation. Trump is not as strong or as respected or as dominant as people want to picture him. And the Democrats showed, I mean, they got a toehold again in the House. Where does this go from here?
If you look at the electoral map, you see that the Democrats basically have the urban cosmopolitan vote, and everywhere else votes Republican. That's not healthy. When you look at the popular vote is held by the Democrats because they basically have the urban votes, and there's more people live in cities than live elsewhere. And then the electoral college and the distribution of senators, etc., all of that gets complicated by this. But, you know, at the end of the day, we have a highly divided society. It turns out that some of the values that people like you and I hold dear, non-racial biases, preference for immigration, a multiculturalist, pro-redistribution, it turns out lots of people actually don't think that way. And we've got to a point whereby rather than actually engage with those people and figure out why that is and what type of society they would actually like to have, etc., we just spend time demonizing each other. We don't listen. They're wrong. They're somehow just morally suspect. And that's what our politics has got down to. And when you get there's nowhere to go.
There's got to be somewhere, Mark.
There is. Back to the pub.
Brianna Gray, we tune in on Mark Blythe pretty regularly, and always our listeners say they want to hear Democrats talk just like that. Is there one out there?
Who's able to talk across party lines and who is able to engage with people in the country who have significant ideological differences? I think that there are. I think that there are several within the progressive movement, most notably, most famously, Bernie Sanders. You know, he's the one who got in some trouble today for what I think amounts to a minor gaffe, because he basically refused to call Trump voters racist, right? Hmm. And we're in this place where kind of identifying racism, like calling, speaking truth to power, calling, call out culture, if you will, has become a substitute for advancing broader goals. So I agree that there are a lot of people in the world, who, a lot of people in this country who hold racist beliefs, who take racist actions, who vote for candidates who are racist and who trade on racism in order to kind of generate enthusiasm around their candidacy. But the question is rarely asked, how do we approach people in a way that best conveys that we have a lot of shared goals, and that the racism that is advanced by people at the top in order to keep basically the people in the working classes divided from each other, from forming a coalition that would be big enough and powerful enough to topple the oligarchy, you know, how do we talk to those people in a way that can convince them that the real enemy is not immigrants or people of color or what have you, but it is the people holding the purse strings, it is the 1%. And that conversation itself has become highly stigmatized. So if you say, let's talk about people's racist actions instead of calling them racist, that becomes apologizing for racism or
I want to put it to David Bromwich. Brianna, forgive me, but I want David Bromwich. Every time we talk to Mark Blythe, people on the street say, I get him entirely. Will we ever hear that kind of rough candor about the silences in our system, David?
Rough candor, that's a good way of describing it. I think that somebody like Sherrod Brown is an example. Sanders is in many ways, too, although the word socialist attached to him is going to have other effects than depriving him of corporate money. But he's certainly been able to say things, for example, agreeing with Trump when Trump was saying Amazon isn't paying its fair tax share. Most Democrats wouldn't dare to agree with Trump. Hmm. Sanders had the nerve to do that. I think people admire Trump for one good reason, which they mistake the content of, and the reason is he seems to be fearless. He seems to say whatever he thinks. He is, in fact, reckless, but he understands the glamour that his audience want from him. And there need to be Democrats who seem fearless while being more thoughtful, and that's a quality I'm afraid neither Hillary Clinton nor Barack Obama projected very adequately. But I think there are many, and I think another might be Amy Klobuchar, for example. I mean, there really is talent, not only among the very young, but among some of the middle generation who were too long in the shadow of the Clintons and Obama.
But Mark Blythe is merciless about saying what we don't talk about. We don't talk about economic fairness because the candidates are bought. We don't talk about immigration because the anger it stirs is just too scary. And we don't talk about the climate because it seems almost beyond rescue.
Well, planetary climate disruption is the great issue of our time. And the reason we avoid it, Democrats and Republicans, far more dishonestly, right, because they are in perfect denial about it. The reason we avoid it is that it's going to need some form of international control. Not one nation can control it, but many nations collaborating. And for that, the U.S. has to have more confidence in a unified national self-feeling and pride in starting to solve the world's problems again, not by war. And this is a very hard thing to get into. But boy, did it need to be talked about between 2008 and 2016. Mm-hmm. It was not much. And now you have one whole party shutting it down and closing their eyes.
Brianna Gray, speak to the remarkable high standard that AOC, Ocasio-Cortez, has set. I had a moment, well, 10 moments with her, shook her hand, felt her energy, her intelligence, her goodness. Who's going to meet that standard? Would that we all might.
You know, I think that when you have candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and when you have candidates like Bernie Sanders, for whom she campaigned and from whom she takes a great deal of political inspiration, it's contagious. It was contagious from Bernie to AOC. And it continues to spread across the Democratic Party. Now, not as quickly as I would like to hope, but already the energy around those candidates has forced all of perceived as 2020 contenders to at least adopt the most significant and most popular policies that have come out of the progressive left. Medicare for all, $15 minimum wage, et cetera. Hmm. Now, I think the part that has yet to translate as much is this really inspiring and kind of compelling call for policies and a worldview that basically supports a bare minimum of human dignity.
Yes.
Human dignity is a word that Ocasio-Cortez says a lot. And I think it's really politically important because it's something that you can't contest, you can't deny, you can't argue about without basically seeming like a horrible person. And there's something almost spiritual about that call without being overtly religious. And I think, you know, I have a friend, a colleague at Current Affairs who argues that the candidate who wins the election is the candidate that reminds the voters most of a spiritual leader and not just a politician.
David Brumage, could I ask you, I mean, I don't want to say Ocasio-Cortez has eclipsed Bernie exactly, but she's extended the lure of his message, and she's put it in sort of Bronx family terms. It's almost irresistible.
Well, I've only seen her in a couple of extended interviews on The Intercept, and she came out very well in those. They were friendly interviews, but she is sharp, knows a lot of substantive things that a politician needs to know. So, the attractiveness of that idealism and of that politics, I think, is there. And I agree, as a Sanders supporter myself, to put all those cards on the table. I do think other words besides dignity might be used more by the Democrats. Honor and honorable, integrity, constitution and constitutional. Those words would do a lot of work that are not work that is not done by words like narcissistic, misogyny, homophobic, Islamophobic. The words that are used as pejoratives to accuse Trump of being a hater, I think, go a very small way. And I'd be glad to see the Democrats taking their stand on something that's much more their own and much more in the American grain.
Marvelously spoken. Breonna Gray, do you want to take us toward the goal here?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Look, I think that a lot of the words that we do use to describe Trump and many of his supporters are accurate. But the question has to be not just are we accurately calling out bad acts and racist and bigoted and prejudiced beliefs, but whether or not we are advancing toward the goal that I think we should have, which is making people feel like those aren't beliefs that they should adopt. And we live in a world where people don't believe us when we say that they're prejudiced because they feel basically like we're the boy that called wolf. And we have to, at some point, I think, start to put things in terms that people understand. And I think talking in more moralistic terms actually gets to the heart of the issue better and does so in a way that gives people opportunity to grow and improve rather than labeling them as a racist, which suggests something that's very static and irredeemable.
Moralistic or moral or both? David Brumage?
I was going to add to that, do that rather than correcting people's usage of certain words or certain expressions and saying you find it offensive, which gives the impression of being a schoolmarm, policeman, hall monitor, what you will. And that's a desperately bad posture for Democrats to cast themselves in. It comes out of the academy. It's gone into journalism and into politics. And I think there was a breath of fresh air that blew from a different quarter this time, and I hope it keeps going.
Give me an example of just what you mean, but the language that's infiltrated politics and journalism and common talk.
Well, it happened in 2016 in the Clinton-Sanders primary, where people started talking about Bernie Sanders as coming from a very white state. He came from a white state, and it doesn't matter so much the won the New Hampshire primary because that's a white state. And Trump is under suspicion because the people who come to his rallies, like those who come to Sanders' rallies, are, quote, angry white men. Mm. Not good. I mean, for one thing, once you've located people's interests or their origins, you haven't said anything about their views. And even if you hear them say something that is bigoted, you haven't figured out where that's coming from and what you want to do with it politically. Because most people are not incurable, though many are misguided.
Mm. I've learned a lot this hour. Thank you, David Bromwich. Thank you, Breonna Gray. Thank you, Mark Blythe and David Bosworth and Jill Lepore. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Rebecca Panovka, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks engineered the show along with Matt Lizette. Mary McGrath is the speaker of our house. I'm Christopher Lydon. I just do the talking. Join us next time for Open Source.